radioalburn.com.
Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 7th of February 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live at radioalbion.com tonight, because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, the Freemasonic Victory of World War II, and the soon-to-be-released Churchill's Body Count, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good evening to you, sir. How are you?
Good evening. I'm okay. You know, it could get tiring running around trying to find Churchill's body count, by the way.
There's rather a large body count there to get into, I should imagine.
Relentless wasn't the word.
Well, there's loads there, isn't there? I mean, tonight we're going to be looking at the Blyberg reparations. And, you know, I've looked at your video and I've tried to find out some more about it. And, you know, I don't know how you managed to fit it all into one video. There was so much that actually went on here. So many different things to get into. And yet you've got to try and condense it down and just tie it into Churchill. But it's something that I would recommend all our listeners actually have a look at. Just have a look at that Wikipedia page and see everything that went on there and realize that that's, you know, mainly that's a cover-up, but just all the details of it's so complicated, and the information is just coming out, well, over the last 20 years, basically. Mm. Nothing was really known about this at the time.
It's probably the reason why I went through school without getting the beating.
Because you didn't know about it.
No one actually knew about Croatia being on the German side.
Well, perhaps you... But we better remind listeners about this and about your heritage, Dennis, and you know, your inspiration for what you do.
Yeah. Well, it is the main reason why I decided to do The Greatest Story Never Told, because I obviously lost family at Blyberg. So I knew about it for obviously since I was a child. But it was one of the best kept secrets of World War II. And, you know, whenever Churchill's name was mentioned, like, my dad growled. So, yeah, I mean, when I thought about it, there's, you know, should I do it, should I not? It wasn't really much of a discussion inside my head.
So he told you everything that sort of went on. And did your dad was, he was a refugee. Was he escaping at this time, or was he a kid at this time? How did he end up over
there?
No,
he was escaping. Actually, he was a devout Catholic, and he used to carry a picture of Saint Anthony, who was, you know, his favourite saint. He was named the same, and he got to a point in Austria where they were all heading towards Austria, and he had two friends with him, and they got to a point where they knew the roads were never going to get dangerous, and so they decided to split up. His two friends, one went left, one went right, round the mountain, and my dad went up and over the mountain. And my dad found out later, once he got word back, that they never made it, his two friends.
And this was at the end of the war. This was fleeing from the Red Army, basically, to surrender to the British rather than surrendering to the Soviets.
Yeah, that's right, because they thought the West was the better place to surrender. Like I said to you last week, I said in Europe there's a consensus now of never trust the British, and this is one of the reasons.
But your father was able, he was able to actually, did he make his way to Britain, or did he make his way to surrender to the British and they looked after him? What happened there, do you know?
No, he made his way to Britain. He had some friends who'd gone ahead, and so they kind of paved the way for him.
So he managed to bypass the surrendering to the British bit then?
Yeah. Whereas his brother and his father, I think it were two brothers and his father, were both on the trains.
And this is because the people that did surrender to the British, they were basically stabbed in the back by the British.
Yeah, they were told they were going to go to Italy.
And what so they were, because some of our listeners probably don't know that much about this bit of history, Dennis. So, so what happened to these Croatians that were attempting to surrender to the British? And there were thousands of them, weren't there?
Yeah, once the Germans collapsed, you know, the war was over for the Germans. They were still fighting down there because they had to keep routes open because the communists were trying to hunt them down, and they would have killed every single one of them, family as well, pets, dogs, the lot. So they had to make a way, and the place to go everyone was heading for was Austria. And so fighting all the way there, to manage, because don't forget they're taking all the family away, and they can't even leave the family behind. You know, their sons, their daughters, their uncles, their granddads, all go with them. And so this mass exodus out of Yugoslavia was heading towards Austria, and where the British were, commanders in that military zone. And when they got to Austria, obviously, there's different accounts. Most of them surrendered to the British. The British wouldn't accept surrender from some and pass them on to the partisans. But all this time, there'd been a deal struck at the one with Stalin and Churchill.
Was that the Yalta one?
Yalta, yeah, where they'd agreed to send all these prisoners of war back. And even America joined in at one point. So, the point being, Tito, who was communist as well, and these Soviet troops down in Yugoslavia wanted these prisoners sent back, not to stand trial, but as we'll find out, probably one of them was probably one of the most horrible deaths I can think of.
Yeah, it's really horrific. So they had these brave men, brave fighters, trying to keep the Red Army off so that the refugees and the families and the children could all make their way along this corridor to get there to Austria, where they thought that they were going to be safe. Now, I think one of the groups that you were saying that they wouldn't accept the surrender and they had to surrender to the partisans then just mowed them all down. Well, once they had waved the white flag and they'd had their weapons taken from them, 15 minutes later, the partisans just massacred them all. And I think that's the massacre that took place in a field. And I think that's the one that's actually called the Blyberg Massacre. Is that correct?
Well, there's a couple of them went on. That was initially when they first arrived. They were promised safe passage if you surrendered, and you were treated well. Communists do what communists do. As soon as you surrendered, they mowed them all down. Then there was another day when the British, I think it was Alexander, was the general, and he got in touch with Tito and said, look, you've got so many Croats over there, we can send you some more. And obviously Tito was highly delighted. And so they went about sending these British troops, sending the rest of these Croatians over to the partisans. And this is, like I say, just a day or so, or 2 days after they all arrived. Anyway, they're in a field, and once they've got no weapons, and the communists realise that they're no danger and they can't defend themselves, they just started to mow them down, and another mass of bodies of women, children, kids, and the soldiers, unarmed.
And there was different groups, weren't there? There was Croats, there was Ustasha, there was Chetniks. Yep. I think there was some Serbian group or other, and it was like there were groups of Slavs that had aligned with the communist forces, and there was groups of Slavs that had aligned themselves with the Axis forces.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Chetniks were against the national Croatians to start with, but I think something happened and they swapped sides at one point. They left the Serbs and went with the Croatians. And it's just it is confusing, there's some Serbs fought with the Croatians as well, you know what I mean? So not every Serb was looked on as a bad guy. And of course, like I said, we've got different groups. I mean, the Ustasha, they were the better armed and the tougher of the other group, which was the Home Guard, like type of thing, which had a they had a tendency of deserting when the going got tough, but the Ustasha was the other way around.
And a lot of them sort of they changed sides and changed allegiances, but by the time it came to the end of the war, it was basically everybody needs to get out before the Red Army gets here. We need to get away from the Red Army.
Yeah, because it's shooting in a barrel time, isn't it? Fishing a barrel, because obviously you've got no army now to defend you, civilians especially, and if the Red Army come along, they're going to do what they do. Just like they did in Germany and worse. But the problem was, once the British, and this comes straight down from Churchill, to hand them back over, once the British had agreed to hand them back over, in the first couple of days, there was the massacre in the fields. But then the rest of the Croatians, because there were a lot there, they said they'd put on trains and they'd send them to Italy. And what they did was send them straight back to the communists.
And that's what your video mainly deals with. It mainly deals with interviews with the British Army personnel that were there, that saw this happening, that were responsible for making sure that they got on the trains, and it's asking them what their views were on this. And it's interesting stuff. It's very emotional. You can see that... One of these guys, he was very, very affected by what he saw. And you can see that it's still affecting him now. He's chain smoking. His eyes end up watering at the end of the interview. And, you know, he's a real hard nut. You know, this is a real tough guy. So to reduce him to that 70 years later, you know, I mean, it must have been horrific what he saw. Or maybe 60 years later. When was it that this came out? Because it came out because of the interviewer that got these interviews, and that was when it really exploded, wasn't it?
Well, the thing was that Yugoslavia was under communist control after World War II, so very little leaked out there. And obviously the British involvement, they didn't really want to be leaking out anything about that over here, so it was pretty much a given secret. But this interviewer... What he did, his family had moved to America after the war. So he grew up in America and he had an American accent, but he is obviously of Croatian descent, which the people he interviewed didn't realize. You know, they just thought it was an American journalist. So he lined up all these interviews. He was determined to get the last remains of the military, what were there, the eyewitnesses from that side, and to interview them. And because of his American accent, they managed to freely open up to him, because if he'd have had anything of a different or a European, you know, Eastern accent, it just wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, I'd like to know what Mr. I recalls of this happening, because, you know, he was around at the time. He was around back then in the 30s and the 40s. And, you know, he was quite up on what was happening during the war. So I'd like to know what he knew about this. And or whether he knew about it at all, whether it was reported at all. So that would be interesting. I want to talk to him about all this stuff that you've been bringing up about Churchill, just to find out what what the British people thought of it at the time. Obviously, we're condemning it now, but it'd be interesting to know just how it was looked on by them. Well, let's get into the transcript of the video then, and these will all eventually come out. For everybody else to see, but they're not finished yet, so that's why they're not available yet. And you keep adding to them, as you always do, Dennis. Well, I think it might end up being another 2-3 hour long one, actually.
Could well be.
I'm not sure you're going to be able to fit in all these bodies otherwise. Well, this is part 4, the Blyberg Reparations. The Blyberg Reparations occurred in May 1945 at the end of World War II. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers and civilians associated with the Axis powers fled Yugoslavia to Austria as the Red Army and the Yugoslav partisans hunted them down. After the surrender of Croat soldiers and their families, who were known as camp followers, to the British Army, under orders from Winston Churchill, they were sent back to Yugoslavia. where they were either executed on arrival or raped, beaten, and killed on forced death marches. And then you've got some really horrific bits of video and some horrific photographs. There's some video of it looks like people being shot and falling down from a wall. Is that what is happening there?
That was an execution of the statue that, yeah.
So that's execution that are going on there, and there's a pile of bodies that are underneath them. Then you've got images of dead and mutilated bodies, and they reminded me of the pictures that we've seen of the mutilated Germans, you know, that happened at Danzig before before Germany actually went into Poland. There was this mutilation of these bodies, torturing people to death by digging their eyes out and things like that. And, you know, it looked like the same thing was happening here. You know, is this a communist sort of thing, or because I think it is.
There's been discovered, you know, since 1945, probably a thousand of these pits, maybe more. There's even suggestion that even in the capital in Zagreb, there's still bodies, you know, left to be unearthed. They didn't leave no stone unturned, these guys. I mean, they are what they are, you know.
They were savage torturers, basically.
Same as the Bolsheviks, all, you know, they're the same, there's no different.
Is that Bolshevik mentality? And then there's a really horrific one. There's a tunnel, or what looks like a tunnel, and it's just filled with bones. So tell us what that is.
Yeah. Well, that is one of the graves they found. I'm not sure which one it was. But what it meant were that they were putting all these people into one place, either shooting them, or as I mentioned on this other one, which was I just think it's just the most horrible way to die, the one with the mine.
Yeah, you mentioned later on that they put loads of people in a mine and then they just concreted the mine shut. So then
there were 1,200 were put in the mine. There were 12,000, I can't remember what I got there. But anyway, there were 12,000 put in this mine, including 2,000 women and children. And then they sealed the mine and covered it in concrete. So they burned them alive. They're going to be in pitch black. They're going to be screams for days. I mean, talking 12,000 people, it's going to take a while to die. They're either going to die of starvation, die of lack of air, whatever. It just, to me, it's just a horrific way to kill people, really was.
Really horrific. And, you know, it looks to me that you've got the proof of that there. You've got this tunnel and it's just filled with all these bodies. That's why I was wondering if one of the shots was actually off this. You think what we've been told about the Holocaust and, you know, there were these Jews that were gassed and there's no evidence for that. And then,
this is a genocide.
There's evidence for this. You know, it's just full of bodies and skeletons and skulls. You think 12,000 people, including 2,000 women and children, suffocated to death. And you would have heard the screams, wouldn't you?
From the outside. All in the dark. You know, it must have been horrific.
Absolutely horrific. These horrific things have been projected onto the Germans that they were doing this, and all along it was the Soviets that were doing this. And getting back to the transcript, you say they had boarded trucks and trains after being told they were to be taken to Italy, but instead they were sent back unarmed to the waiting communists. Now, you were telling me before we went on air that some of them were committing suicide on the train. Is that right?
Yeah, well, they knew, you know, they've no arms now. They're going to get sent back to the heart of their enemy, and they knew exactly what the enemy was, and, you know, like we know what Bolsheviks were. So what some managed to do were break the windows and cut the wrists before they got there, because they knew it were going to be, this is not going to be good.
And you think as well, they've just been told by the British that it's okay, they're going to be taken to Italy if they get on this train. And then they realise that the train's going in the wrong direction and it's taking them back to where they just, you know, and you imagine like
where they just ran from, yeah.
Yeah, well, not just run from, but the struggle that they went through to get to Austria you know, struggling through the Red Army, being shot at, you know, just climbing over the barbed wire and around mines and seeing
babies. Yeah, it's
desperate struggle to get to what you think is safety. And then the people where you should have been safe with, they lie to you and say, well, we'll keep you safe. We'll send you off to Italy. Just give us your weapons. You're quite safe now. And they put you back on a train to waiting doom, basically, to the grave. Now, we've got an eyewitness to the boarding of these trucks, because you were telling, it's not just trains, but there was trucks that they loaded up as well. This is Zoenka Palik-Kuzan. She said, then suddenly British lorries came along, one after the other, which loaded all the people up, which took the whole day. So this was lots and lots of lorries that came along, because they were just, as soon as one had picked up all the people, it had left, and then another one was there straight away. So, you know, it must have been hundreds of lorries. She said, we asked where we are going, and they said to a military camp. And where did they take them? They took them directly to, and then she says, some country, city.
Well, it sounds like Bloomberg, to be honest. She wasn't in the truck. She was asking the lads, because she said they were quite young, 17, 18, 19, 20, and they're asking, where are you going? And they just shouted, oh, we're going to the military camp, quite happily, thinking they're going, obviously, to a place of safety. But she believes that she was taken straight to the killing fields and mowed down.
They're just taken off to be executed somewhere. You know, again, we know that this is what the Soviets did in Poland with the Kachin massacre, wasn't it? They just rounded up all the intelligentsia and the generals and the officers, and they just took them all out to the forest where they had a big pit, and they just shot them all into this pit. 20,000
of them. These people who follow communism, you know, think communism is something special, really need to wake up.
Oh, it just hasn't been tried properly yet, Dennis. Just hasn't been tried properly yet.
That's the usual excuse. Yeah.
Well, yeah, then you move on to Slovenia. So Slovenia is a different part. Yeah, we've got Yugoslavia, yeah? So maybe you can explain this to me, because you're saying these people have been sent back to...
Yugoslavia. I always hated that word, Yugoslavia, because to me that was like, you know, Croatia had won, Hitler had given Croatia their independence for the first time in 900 years. So they thought the world of Hitler, but it took straight back off them, and they're under this communist regime now of Yugoslavia, which was, you know, the Serbia, which was the dominant country, Slovenia, Macedonia, Croatia, and all these other ones, which all gel together down there as the Balkans, which stood till the 90s when civil war broke out and all the old wounds were opened up again, and consequently we had the massacres again down there. But this Yugoslavia was a state run by Tito, who was another type of Stalin. He was actually Croatian, believe it or not, and he was just as ruthless, and to kill thousands of families and children is nothing to him.
So Slovenia was a part of Yugoslavia. So
that's right.
But before when the war was on, was there a Slovenia, a Croatia, a Serbia, a Macedonia? Were they all separate? And then at the end of the war, it was all given to Tito. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, before Hitler gave Croatia the independence, it was Yugoslavia. We all them countries again. But once the war, once Hitler gave Croatia the independence, I mean Croatia broke away. I presume some of the others did as well. But as soon as the war finished, they were back under that communist anvil.
Right, but obviously a part of it would have still been called Slovenia. That area would have still been Slovenia.
Yeah, and Bosnia as well. That's another one.
Herzegovina. Yeah, all these places. I mean, we know the names because we know them from the news, as you say, from recent troubles. Well, just a decade ago. Another of the many massacres that followed was at a mine near Pechovnik, Slovenia, on May the 9th, 1945. The partisans forced 12,000 Croats, including 2,000 women and children, to enter it. The mine was then sealed and covered in concrete. I mean, that is so horrific. Is that just one instance of that, or was that something that they just did?
they can think of these ideas, can't they? They're very good at horrific deaths. I'll give them that. So I'm pretty sure, you know, this was emulated in a lot of places. I mean, you saw with the forces of shore, this guy in a helmet going down like a rabbit hole. And once he'd gone down this hole into the cave below, you saw the bones and the bullet, the bullet holes in the skulls.
Yeah, well, I was wondering if that was the mine, because it looked like just like powdered skeletons and bones.
No, that was in a part of Croatia, that one. This was in Slovenia, the other mine. So there's a lot of these going on.
I mean, when you think of these sort of things, you think of Pol Pot, don't you? You think of Cambodia.
Yeah, that's right.
You think of that
skulls,
sort of
yeah.
thing happening there. You don't think of it happening in white countries in the last century to white people.
Oh, it was bad. It was bad.
Well, you move on to the interviews then, and the interviews are interspersed with different people. And what I've done, I've put all the interviews with one person in one place, so we can go through all of them with the same character. And the first interview is with Captain Nigel Nicholson, who speaks with quite a posh accent. And the interviewer says, "Were you given orders to send all Croatians in the area back to Rosenbach via the Welsh Guard Brigade, and that they in turn would be turned over to Tito's partisans?" And Captain Nigel Nicholson of the British 8th Army says, "Yes, of course the orders didn't come directly to us. It came down the chain of command, and we received them from the 6th Army Division on the 16th of May, but we were told not to immediately put it into action. It was acted upon 3 days later, on the 19th of May, when we began to evacuate the first batches of Croats from Rosenbach at a small train station called Maria Alende. And this continued for the next 5 days, sending them to Yugoslavia." And then the interviewer says, "Were the Croats and other anti-Yugoslav ethnics told what their destination was?" And Captain Nicholson says, "No. We received specific orders from our division that they were not to be told where they were going, as naturally they were very anxious that they should not be sent back to Yugoslavia, and they suspected this. We were told a few days..." Go on.
I'm just going to say that I think they learned the lesson, actually. If you remember in The Greatest Story Never Told, the Cossacks were sent back, but the Cossacks found out they were going back, and they're fighting for 3 days and three nights. It was just with the British soldiers who baseball battered them onto their trains. So they'd learn from that one. They thought, well, we just won't say nothing, just tell them to go to Italy. And obviously it was less stress.
Well, you would think that they might have suspected something if this had been going on for 5 days. You know, word might have come back.
Maybe.
Something might have happened, but doesn't seem that it did. Captain Nicholson...
But you've got weapons. It's a problem, isn't it? You've handed all your weapons in.
Yeah. Captain Nicholson continued, "We were told a few days later that we were to tell them that they were going back to Italy. In the case of the Serbs, that they were going to join their friends, the Chetniks, at Parmanova in northeast Italy. And this lie, which we, with the greatest reluctance, was ordered from above, and of course, if they had learned the truth that they were going back to Yugoslavia, where they did not expect to survive, none of them would have mounted the railway trucks. But as they trusted us, that we were telling the truth, there wasn't much trouble about loading them in." I mean, that's tragic, isn't it?
But, yeah, it's there's no real words for it, really. It's just... You should be sent to death unknowingly, trusting,
Well, they said it was with the greatest reluctance that they did it. At least, you know, they weren't happy about it. The British Army were not happy about having to do this. And this is a captain.
Yeah, I don't believe they were happy about it, to be honest.
And he's saying that it was orders that came down from above, down the chain of command.
Yeah. Well, I always say with the Nuremberg trials, like whenever a German said, "Look, I was only taking orders," it was totally ignored. It meant nothing. But you know, and I know, and people listening know that if you disobey an order in the army, you're going to suffer. Whether you know, you could even be shot for disobeying orders. So you really don't have much choice.
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, I've had this conversation recently as well. I mean, it's the same with the police, the same with the army. They have to obey their orders, and if they don't, you know, if they disagree with the orders, then they have to resign, and then they can take the issue up. Because if everybody was to start disobeying the orders, you would have no discipline, you would have corruption, your army wouldn't function anymore, or your police force wouldn't function anymore. You can be a conscientious objector and just resign, basically. I'm surprised that some of these guys didn't, and they probably, or one of them, I think, definitely feels bad about it.
When you think about World War One and the soldiers who wouldn't go over the wall or the trenches, they were just shot. You know, that's for not going over the trenches. So, you know, you can understand soldiers being wary of it all.
Well, the fact that it wasn't just soldiers comes up next. The question is, well, what of the civilians? And Captain Nicholson says, I remember asking for advice from the division. Are we to send the civilians?
Churchill comes into his own there, isn't it?
Yeah, he says, are we to send the civilians as well? And the answer came back, yes, if they are camp followers. So I asked, what is a camp follower? A camp follower is any person, gender or age who is dependent on the soldiery for their livelihood. That meant everybody. So it meant the children, the wives, everybody that turned up there.
Everybody.
Because there is an argument they could say, well, these guys were fighting against us during the war, and they can be judged by the people they were fighting against. They can be judged by the partisans. But the women and the children weren't fighting in the war.
Exactly.
And doing that to the civilians is a war crime.
One would think so.
Well, Captain Nicholson agrees. He says it's one of the most disgraceful operations the British troops have ever been asked to undertake. We felt that at the time. Many of us expressed it at the time. I expressed it in writing in a public document and was reprimanded for doing so. So he must have made it public, at least.
Yeah.
And what I'm wondering about is what the date was when he did that. What year
was
it?
It's an interesting one. But you see, with the media under control, very difficult to get things out.
Yeah, well, the press probably wouldn't have printed it, would they? But maybe somebody would have published it. You know, maybe he published it in book form or something.
Possibly.
You know, this is what I'd like to ask Mr. Rye about, whether any information came out, whether there was a whistleblower on what was going on here. Now, you mentioned that the same had happened to the Cossacks, Dennis. Can you recall exactly what happened there?
Yeah, 40,000 Cossacks, which were fighting in the Balkans. They were perfect fighters for the Balkans. And when the war came to an end, obviously, they were led by the German general, whose name didn't spring to mind at the moment, but he actually turned around when all the Cossacks were going to be sent back to the Soviet Union. He could have stayed in Germany. He didn't come under that ruling. But he said that I'm with the Cossacks in good times, I'll stay with them in bad times, and actually went back to the Soviet Union with them. And I had a photograph of him on trial with his head shaven, which I could never find again. Which was a shame, but he was known to the Cossacks, at least the Cossacks who were fighting against Stalin, as the last knight of Europe.
And did the Soviets put him on a show trial? Did they humiliate him, put him in a show trial, or did they just get rid of him?
I think they put him on a trial and executed him. That's simple as.
Yeah, it's not on, is it, when they're telling us today, oh, we've got to accept all these refugees that are coming here, when, you know, this is the way that we treated the white refugees. But of course, they would probably use the treatment of the Cossacks and the treatment of the Croats as reason for why we have to accept refugees today.
I mean, the great excuse is that we're an ageing population.
Yeah, what was the excuse here? I mean, what was the excuse to send these people back? I mean, it can only have just been done out of vindictiveness, because they'd been fighting on the side of the Germans. But to then hand them over to the communists.
It's a war of ideology. And whenever you get a case of ideology, the winner will, if it's any sense, wipe out the defeated, because as long as there's an ember burning somewhere, that could come back on them. And I think the Germans would have done the same with the communists. And the communists, unfortunately, won that war. So they did exactly to the Germans and the Axis. Why they hunted them down, but they hunted them down in such an evil way. It wasn't just a question like, you know, let's shoot them, let them suffer, and the children as well.
Well, the Serbs and the Croats at the end of the war, the Serbs and the Croat leaders said, look, we'll go and surrender to the British because they will need us as anti-communist forces.
Yeah,
and they thought they'd be used.
They thought that they'd wake up and see the communists as the real threat, which Patton was one who did. But obviously, what Patton didn't realise was that the leaders, the Freemason leaders of these armies, already knew about the communists. They were funding them, as the banker mates were.
Yeah, the bankers were funding them. But there's always good men in the armies. I mean, after that, they did sort of realise. Or, you know, do you think that it was just put on then, the Cold War, that and that, because after this they sort of said, well, hang on a minute, actually Stalin is a threat, and we better send the Germans over to America, the rocket scientists, so that they can get the edge on the Soviets with weaponry and with rockets, yeah, and all that sort of thing. So they did sort of realise that the Soviets were going to be a threat.
The thing was, Stalin turned at some point, and so they went through a period of uncertainty with Stalin, because he took all of Europe, Eastern Europe, which the bankers would have been privy to, but obviously if you fall out with Stalin, Stalin's not going to let you. So there was a period, but once Stalin was poisoned by the Jews, then the people who took over then were friendly to the American bankers. Their own people got back in again, Khrushchev and all them. So, but they then kept the Cold War going, because the threat of an attack is good for business. You always like to have an enemy, because the weapons are made and weapons make money.
So you think Stalin went rogue?
Yeah, I think he did. Yeah,
because we had this operation. Go on.
Well, I was just going to say, I personally believe that he saw Masonic papers he shouldn't have. He was never meant to see. He took a whole train load back to Moscow, and it showed the power of what Freemasonry had over the world. And I don't think he liked what he saw. Maybe what were even intended for him,
Because they had the Operation Paperclip, didn't they?
That was to get scientists. I mean, everybody dived into Germany for the patterns because how advanced they were. And certainly Stalin got some scientists, but the Americans got some scientists as well, because apparently they took these V2 rockets back to America and their own scientists couldn't work it out. So they needed the Germans to work it out.
Yeah, and the military men thought that they would be the same. They thought that they would be required as well. So that was part of the, if we go to the British, we'll be okay, because they will need us. They will need us as military men and with the information that we've got. But no, just hand them over to Stalin.
Yeah.
The next interview is with Major General Bredin from the British 8th Army. The interviewer says, do you think that one of the other factors that we haven't considered yet is maybe it was because many of these people were Slavs, that they came from nationalities that most British soldiers did not understand, and that they were considered foreign people that were somewhat of a nuisance? Do you think this may have helped facilitate the handovers? Major General Bredin says it's possible. A lot of these people did look pretty cutthroat, as you might say. Well, they've just been fighting a war, haven't they? He said, exactly. I think the British soldiers felt most sorry for the women and the children who accompanied them, and they thought that this was terrible, this refugee problem, and they were prepared to do things for the women and the children, which they wouldn't have been prepared to do for the men quite often. And then he said, I think the British have always looked sideways at foreigners and saw themselves as superior to them, and that the foreigners had curious ways of behaving. In fact, the soldiers got on very well with the Austrians, but they were people who hadn't been disturbed much and didn't look much like refugees. They were just living there the same as they had throughout the war. I mean, that's very shallow of him, isn't it? Very shallow.
Well, there's always been a snobbery in the officer of the British Army, certainly around that time. And that's understandable, you know what I mean? But I just think that, the ordinary British soldier is obviously ignorant to the rest of the world. They all live in houses far superior to what, some of the down in Eastern Europe were. And they probably took that train of thought that they were superior, but I don't think it's a bit like this racist thing. It really, really bugged me when, for instance, when somebody gets done in a football match for shouting something like, "You black so and so so," well, if that guy was wearing, I was 20 stone and white, he'd be called a fat so and so so. I don't think the racism comes into it. It's just what you see and how you perceive and how you shout. And I think it's the same thing down in the Balkans with the British soldiers. I mean, they weren't, they're out of the comfort zone.
Yeah, and we've already heard about how the interview with the Germans and they were talking about the Russians and how the Russians lived in these wooden huts. So they didn't think it was, that much of a problem to set fire to them because they could always just go and build another one, couldn't they? And they saw they saw themselves as superior. So it wasn't as if this was an out of the ordinary way to be. And no. I think, maybe what this guy's doing is basically just giving a neutral description of what went on. And
well, the officer would have been snobbish to his own men. Never mind.
Yeah.
Foreigners. I mean, because they just didn't mix with their own men, did they? They've got their own officers' club and whatever.
And you do go on first appearances. And if you're looking at somebody who is, is really, grimy and covered in soot and ripped clothing, you're not going to think that much of them.
Fighting communists all the way for the last 20 miles. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And he does say that they did feel, compassion and concern for the women and the children. And that's a chivalrous way to be, is concerned about the women and the children. And that's something that all white men are like, we feel compassion for women and children. Yeah. And then he finishes by saying, "I think particularly the people who came up from Yugoslavia were a fierce and unmannerly lot who I don't think the soldiers liked very much and just wished they could chase them back into Yugoslavia." That may sound not too good when you first read that, but then you think, the British Army had just been fighting a war, they just won the war, and, they want it to be over with. They don't want to have to be dealing with this. They want to be going back home to Britain. They don't want to have to deal with, all the internal wars that have gone on in Yugoslavia. They weren't expecting this. They were expecting to have won the war. We're triumphant. We're supposed to be winning something, not have to look after all these people that have just turned up and sort out their problems and prevent them from fighting amongst one another because you've got all those rivalries. So you can have a bit of a compassion there that, they just wish they could, chase them back into Yugoslavia. Get back over there and sort your problems out. It's nothing to do with us.
There was a reason why the Germans took the Ustasha into Stalingrad with them. Because if you're going to fight fire with fire, they're very similar. They were rough and ready, just as a Bolshevik were rough and ready. If you want to take a Bolshevik down, you want to catch a thief, you send a thief.
So they were cutthroat types then, really, as the description
says. No doubt.
Well, the next interview is with Captain Colin Gunner from the British 8th Army, and he looks like he's living in a caravan. He's got a big knife by the side of him. I think that's a gun on the wall. Is that a gun that he's got on the wall?
It looks
there?
It's a gun. Yeah, I thought that.
Yeah, and he looks like he's living either in a hut somewhere or in a mobile home somewhere.
Gamekeeper somewhere. Yeah,
and he's chain smoking. He's got a cigar at one point. He's got a cigarette in the other. Just from looking at that, you can tell this is somebody who's troubled.
Yeah, he's educated as well, though. At times, he does sound educated. He doesn't sound like he's a commoner or such, but,
He's got a gravelly voice, obviously, a drinker, and a smoker, and you wouldn't be like that, because you compare him to the other two that are interviewed.
Totally different, yeah.
I mean, from the tone of the voice, you could say that he's had a similar education, but his life has taken a different turn for some reason.
Definitely.
I think the reason why he was different is because of what he saw. Because the other two interviewers don't talk about actually seeing or hearing anything. They just talk about putting them back on the trains. But this Captain Colin Gunner, he saw some of what actually went on. And it's not actually included in the video that you showed me, Dennis.
It mentions, he was asked if he knew that the people that he could see going over the bridge were going to the deaths. And he said, yeah. And then he was asked later on, did you hear the machine guns from the Yugoslavian side? And he then cracked up and said, do I want to be talking about shooting bloody kids down? This kind of thing.
So he saw that. He saw the women and the children being massacred. He knew what was happening, yeah. He actually saw it. And you can see that, you know, he starts getting water in his eyes and he you know, he doesn't want to remember it. And that's, you know, I would say that's the reason why he's the way he is there. Chainsmoking.
Well, it takes a stance of orders are orders. I had my orders. I had no feelings. But really, that come out to be a bit of an act because later on he cracks on it.
Excuse the silences here. I'm having to cough. I've got a bit of a cold. Yeah, the interviewer says, Count Tolstoy in his book quotes you as saying, even now the full story has never come out. What is the full story? Now, what is this about Count Tolstoy writing a book?
Well, he obviously wrote a book about it and mentioned him in the book, obviously interviewed him, and he's given some quotes. But when he's asked him what is the full story, what he's saying, it's the handing over. You know, the handing over to an ally, that's bottom line. We got told to do it, and that's what we did.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about the book. You know, when this book
was
written.
It doesn't mention the title, but I'm sure.
What it's about.
Yeah.
Count Tolstoy, I think I've heard of that name before, but I'm not sure who he is or where from. No. I'll have to look that up. Well, Captain Colin Gunner replies, of course it hasn't. The full story is the handing over of them, giving them back to Russia and the Yugoslavs, handing women, children and people over to an ally. No more, no less. So that's him trying to justify it, isn't it? He's saying, look.
It's the only way he can justify it.
Yeah. It's not my problem. They were an ally in the war, and it was that ally's people. They were citizens of that country, so they have to go back there. And that's the logic. So he's just telling himself that, you know, logically, this is what had to happen, so it did happen.
Knew it, so, yeah.
And obviously he's been telling himself that ever since to assuage his conscience. And the interviewer says, did you think that those people marching across the bridge were going to their death at that time? So he's obviously referring to something that is in another video. And he says, yes, absolutely. So he saw that. And the interviewer says, what were your feelings at the time, knowing that these men, women and children would be killed? He says, well, they were my orders, but not my order. I think that's pretty clever, though. You know, he's saying that. He's saying if that had been him, he wouldn't have done it, but they were orders, so he had to do them. He said, I received my orders, and that was it. And then he gets quite angry. He says, that was exactly it. Yeah. To fail is to fail, and orders are orders. I had no feeling whatsoever. And he's like smoking away on his cigarette. I think what he's saying there, to fail is to fail, he meant these guys lost the war.
Yeah.
They lost the war.
That's what we're looking at, isn't it?
So they had to be handed over to the ally.
If it's been agreed, which it has been, he really had no choice.
He just had to do what the people above him told him to do.
There must be thousands of people just like this guy who were there and you know, have to do what they didn't want to do.
All of them.
It's all part of war, isn't it?
Well, pretty much all of them is from what they're saying. The interviewer says, as a soldier at that time, what was the general attitude towards the Croatians? How did you consider them? And he sighs and says, foreign people.
Yeah.
You can see that he's trying to justify this because he feels guilty about it. But the other two don't try to justify it because they didn't actually see the horrors of it. They were just, you know,
they were out of it, weren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, they were just putting them on the trains, whereas this guy actually saw what happened. So he's trying to justify it. The interviewer says, what was the conversation between the common British soldiers about this whole business? And Captain Gunner says, dirty. They didn't like doing it. It was a dirty business, which we did not want to be mixed up in. A dirty, bloody political business in which we did not want to be. We were ashamed of it, and we still are. I mean, it must have been hard for this interviewer to get this out of him, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
And he obviously didn't want to be talking about it. And it's interesting that he hits the nail on the head there, political.
Yeah.
Political business.
That's exactly what I thought. Not politician soldiers, but this is a political decision. It's come right down from the top.
It's not anything the military would have done. Yeah, not anything the military would have done. Do you know that it came from Winston? I mean, what was the idea behind it? What was the motive behind it? Have you got any idea? Well,
it was a meeting with Stalin at Yalta with the agreed it. And like I said, it's all part of this. We kind of think that the Soviet Union was kind of slightly separate to us in America, but really they're well in with us and we're well in with them. Churchill sits down with Stalin quite easily, as like he sits down with Roosevelt. There's no difference. So, these three are what you call allies. And, when Stalin wants them back, Churchill's going to give them back.
Well, surely Churchill must have got something out of it.
I don't know what he got out of it, because at the end of it, he gave half of Europe to Stalin and he will unblast it for it, I think.
Yeah, but didn't Stalin have 20,000 American troops or something that he never never gave back?
That's right, they found it, Operation Keelhaul, they had 20,000 troops over there, just as he kept them as guaranteed that they would send all these POWs back, and he still didn't release them after all that.
So Stalin effectively had hostages. You don't know if he may have had British hostages.
5,000 British, I believe.
Although I can't imagine Churchill being that bothered, actually.
No, he wasn't. He
would have just said, keep them. I don't want them.
Well, no, that would have been Churchill's attitude. This country's not bothered about common people. They'll replace them with Muslims tomorrow. Same thing.
Good point. And the interviewer says, were you given a reason at all? Or were you just given the orders? And he replies, we were ashamed. And he clearly doesn't want to talk about this, and he's starting to show a lot of emotion. He says, we were ashamed of it. We were ashamed of one thing, that we didn't have the guts to say, fuck off.
Yeah.
And, the interview ends there. So that's what he's feeling guilty of, that they didn't revolt and say, no, we're not doing this.
Well, if my memory serves right, I think he thought the interview was over then, but the camera was still running. And the guy who was interviewing left it running, obviously, because he now hit a wall, this guy, and he's getting stuff out of him, which he wasn't getting before. He was getting this standoff, look, it was ordered, it's nothing to do with me, I had my job to do, but now the emotion's coming in, and you're really seeing what the guy's feeling.
Yeah, because he's very emotional there. You can see he's about to break down thinking about it, and obviously, he's carried that guilt all this time that he...
He probably shuts his eyes at night before he goes to bed and it's there.
And he didn't have the courage to do the right thing. I mean, that's really a lesson. If anybody's in a position where they've got a choice between doing the right thing or the wrong thing and it's something important. If you don't do the right thing, 60 years later, you're still going to be ashamed of yourself. You have to do the right thing when you know it's the right thing to do. Next, you get on to Professor Gerald Draper, the World War II crimes prosecutor at Nuremberg and war crimes expert. And he's talking on August the 18th, 1988. And it's very hard to transcribe what he was saying. So I've tried to paraphrase it. And he said, in the light of this tragedy, where people that quite clearly came under the category of refugees were knowingly sent back to Tito, who it was known would decimate them, it should properly be called a war crime. And there may be a serious question as to whether the people involved, a ministerial, military, or civilian, should be held accountable either for not accepting them into British protection or for the forcible repatriation to their immediate execution. And this is the point here, because it was a war crime. So... it was actually breaking the law. It was breaking the treaties. It was breaking British law, breaking military law. And the military would have been all in their rights to say, we're not carrying this out.
Well, the Croatians had signed the Geneva Convention in, I think it was 1943. So that went out the window as well.
You know, it's a question of they're being given orders that are legal, but we don't agree with them. Then, you know, they'd have to carry them out. But if they're being given orders that are unlawful, that go against, you know, their oaths of office as well, then it's their duty to revolt against it. And so, no, we're not doing this. So they shouldn't have resigned. They should have just said, we're not doing this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure it would go against their oath. I mean, a military oath and whatever their oath is, you know, that the military take, it's to the treaties and the conventions that the state have signed themselves up to.
Yeah, I don't think this particular World War One and World War Two, them kind of things went out the window. I mean, I don't think they even bothered stripping the Croatians of the rights. With the Germans, they stripped them so that the, you know, the Red Cross couldn't get to them or anybody.
Yeah, non-combat operatives or something they called them.
Yeah, new category. The same, didn't it,
yeah, a new category of prisoner, so we don't actually have to.
There's no rights. No, you have to feed them, water them.
Yeah, don't have to respect any of their rights.
Yeah.
Well, that's the end of the interviews, and then you get to the official figures. You say, despite the low figures given on Wikipedia, documents located at the British Public Records at Kew Gardens in London revealed 500,000 Croatian civilians and 200,000 soldiers were handed over to Tito's partisan army. So that's 750,000. According to eyewitness reports...
4 million.
4 million. So...
Yeah.
Almost, well, 20% of the country then.
Yeah, that's a proper genocide.
20% of the country massacred. According to eyewitness reports and independent documentation, we can only estimate that the majority, if not all, were slaughtered in what was one of the best-kept secrets of World War II. And then you talk about the interviewer, and you say, all credit for this video goes to Michael Palak, who managed to secure these interviews before the proof of these massacres ordered by Churchill could be lost forever. Although he is an American unknown to those interviewed, he is of Croatian descent and was determined to film the military survivors involved at the time, along with their statements. He believed his American accent was pivotal to the interviews ever taking place, as well as the free-flowing accounts of the crimes that followed. Interesting. Was it part of that same set of interviews where there was an interview with one of the torturers of the Germans that was talking about how the Germans were tortured to get confessions out of them?
No. I think you're talking about Great Story Never Told. I think that was a different, different thing. But certainly, from what I remember, he was awarded some kind of medal in Croatia. Once Croatia had won independence. The Balkan War, they awarded him with some kind of tribute medal for this interview.
Well, this filmmaker.
Yeah.
And they also have, like, Remembrance Days, and I think they've got a memorial stone, and there's thousands of them that go there for a memorial for this. I don't know if they have a public holiday. Yeah, things like, it's awkward to have a public holiday for things like this if you're a part of the EU or if you're trying to be a part of the EU.
Exactly, yeah. And I think it's one of the reasons also that Croatia didn't win the World Cup. I don't think they're ever going to be meant to win the World Cup. People might think I'm silly, but they don't want what were basically still fascists down there, because when they went back to Yugoslavia, they met this guy called Thompson, who does massive rock concerts in Croatia, and all the Ustasha turn out. So these footballers of Croatia, which got to the World Cup final, would have never been allowed to win. They were never going to let fascists win a World Cup in Russia. No way.
Didn't Croatia get into trouble for the Croatian football fans for anti-Semitism or something at some point?
Yeah, well, so one of the footballers was... made a comment about the Ukraine. He didn't get banned from the game, but he got reprimanded. I think they beat Russia in the semi-finals, and he came out with some kind of video praising the Ukraine. But obviously, at that time, there was a lot going on with Putin and the Ukraine. So, yeah, you know, and a lot in that war, that Ukraine war, from Croatia went down into the Ukraine to fight with the Ukrainians, because they're looking at the Russians and the Soviets as, you know, payback time.
Is that what you mean, the recent Ukraine war or back in the Second World War?
No, the recent one.
In the recent one?
Yeah, the mercenaries from Croatia went down there.
Yeah, there's a lot of loyalties from, you know, from places like the Baltics to Ukraine as well.
Well, there's a lot of revenge to be taken down there.
A lot of countries that were occupied by the Soviet Union who have sympathies with Ukraine because of that, even though Russia is no longer the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
That brings us to the end of the podcast, Dennis. Thank you very much for coming on. That was really interesting stuff. I just want to remind listeners that we do require donations to keep the website going. And I've just updated all the details on how people can send us Bitcoin. It's very easy. You just download an Electrum wallet and you can buy Bitcoin from local Bitcoins. You can use PayPal. You can buy £10 worth, £20 worth. You just get that sent to your wallet and then from your wallet to our Bitcoin wallet. It's very, very simple. Anybody can do it. And as I say, it's gratefully received and we do require it to keep the website going. Thank you very much for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend.